Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Politics. I'm Tim Jones, and my guest today is Stefan Auer, author of European Disunion, Democracy, Sovereignty, and the Politics of Emergency, published in the UK in May by Hearst and in the US by OUP during the summer. He writes, with the Eurozone crisis going back to 2010, the refugee crisis that culminated in 2015, the crisis, the EU-Russia relationship going back to the Ukrainian Maidan Revolution of 2013-14, to the COVID-19 crisis in 2020, the EU has struggled to live up to the expectations it raised both in relation to its own people and neighbouring countries. This is not an accident. So what is it? Could this really be by design? In his widely praised new book, Stefan Auer argues that the EU's hybrid form, falling somewhere between a multinational state and a multilateral organization, comes closest to the ideals of Germany, its most powerful member. But this attempt to bypass politics has made it weak in an emergency, and there have been plenty of them. Today, he says, Europeans do not have the luxury of living in a politicsless world. Stefan Auer is an associate professor at the University of Hong Kong, having previously taught in Melbourne and Dublin, and twice held Jean Monnet chairs. A prolific contributor to political science journals, he won the 2005 UAC's Best Book in European Studies Prize for his liberal nationalism in Central Europe. Stefan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for a kind invitation and a kind introduction.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, I've given a quick summary of the book, and it was very quick. Could you set out your case more fully and your inspiration for writing the book now?
Well, the book is about contemporary European politics, and it is about the hubris, I think, that the EU in many ways represents. I think that the noble ideal of European unity was pushed too far, too fast, particularly after 1989. So if there is a culprit, I would name the Treaty of Maastricht, and I hope we can talk about it a bit more. But it was the Treaty of Maastricht that created conditions, for example, for the single European currency, which is one of the symbols of a truly post-national, post-sovereign Europe that the EU was meant to become, in which nation states were no longer meant to play a significant role. And so this is one of the key criticisms I try to develop, that this idea that you can move beyond nation states may well prove counterproductive when it comes to democracy in Europe. So I'm quite agnostic about the value of European unity. My primary commitment is to democracy, right? And I think that the EU that was created through the Treaty of Maastricht is kind of post-political and to some extent post-democratic. So my main concern then is whether the project that seeks to undermine sovereign nation states ends up undermining democracy in Europe. And this is something I believe that we could particularly observe over the last decade, the crisis decade. You mentioned all these sources of crisis and with the rise of emergency Europe. So particularly over the last decade, what we have seen, I believe, is that the EU governance oscillated between technocratic rule of rules and the politics of emergency. And that very term, EU governance, I think captures some of the problems that the EU is facing, right? So the EU famously doesn't have a government, it has a system of governance, and therefore it also doesn't have the kind of actor who is responsible for taking key decisions, right? And in the moments of crisis, key decisions have to be taken all the time. So in the absence of government, then we also don't have enough democratic accountability. So I think that oscillation between the technocratic rule of rules and the politics of emergency, these both modes of governance are damaging to democracy. And perhaps one of the key questions that animates the book is, what is the appropriate size for a democratic polity to work? You know, bigger is not always better, I believe. And I wrote particularly the final, in the final stages of the book, I worked on it from Hong Kong. I teach at the University of Hong Kong, and you don't need to convince many Hong Kongers about that as a truism. Basically, you know that bigger is not always better, particularly when it comes to democratic governance, right? So the question of an appropriate size for a democratic polity is something that I find interesting.
Yeah, and the other thing reading the book is what really jumps out is that Russia, its foreign policy assertiveness, and the contrast of this to the EU is really a central theme of the book. How far into the manuscript were you when Putin started to amass troops on the Ukrainian border? You got an author's note in at the end, but would you have changed anything if you were writing the book now?
I'm extremely grateful you are asking this question, because it is a very strange moment in European history to be releasing a book, you know, that has the ambition to engage the reader about contemporary European politics. And of course, I deal a lot with history of ideas. So I do want to, you know, identify continuities and changes in contemporary Europe. But the moment is such that everything is up in the air, right? Everything is changing. So drastically, dramatically, and not necessarily for the better. And I have to be upfront with you. So I basically finished the book when the situation in Ukraine started deteriorating dramatically. So I submitted the manuscript, that is the whole book, more or less, by the end of November. I negotiated with the publisher, and hers has been extremely accommodating. So I negotiated with them that I would write a short author's note, more frankly, in the expectation that the rule of law crisis, for example, was still very much, you know, going to continue, etc. But then it so happened that I was writing these acknowledgments and a short author's note about 4 weeks after the start of the invasion. And it is strange, because then the key point I try to make is that I might have underestimated the potential for European unity, which is badly needed, of course, in response to that horrible invasion. And now I'm thinking that, unfortunately, we have this unity, and along the lines that are sketched in the book, whereby Germany, despite its bold announcement about the so-called Zeitenwende, you know, a new age in German politics towards Russia and the rest of Europe, that Germany continues in this reluctance, in a way, to speak the language of power, to think strategically, to think about, well, big, difficult questions of war and peace in a frank manner. And then you have the countries of Central and Eastern Europe, who have always been much more suspicious of Russia, and the response seems to be much more robust. So there is that kind of division that I sketch in the book, where one of the chapters, as you would have seen, deals with the EU-Russia relationship. And the key point of that chapter is, again, to criticize the EU's apolitical approach to Russia, that Germany in particular kind of led. And the clash is fascinating, because what you have is the clash between this kind of post-sovereign, post-political Europe on the one hand, and this very traditional sovereignist 19th century style Russia on the other hand, right? And my fear has always been that in that contest, then paradoxically Putin's Russia is stronger than EU's Europe, and I don't want it to be stronger.
Yeah. Well, before we explore the detailed arguments in the book, you give a history of the, well, I mean, you mentioned the history of ideas. You give a history of the theoretical foundations of the EU via Fried, Kozhev, and especially Kelsen and Schmidt. Could you take us briefly through this history and where you ended up finding the best framework for your thinking?
Well, I've been drawn to these thinkers for a long time, and unfortunately, again, I would have to say that particularly now after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, they are more relevant than ever. And this is not accidental because, of course, they are writing at the time of profound upheavals in Europe. Basically, the writings that I have found particularly relevant were mainly produced between the First and the Second World War, right? So they were writing in the shadow of these two catastrophes. And so in terms of history of ideas and for readers who will be interested in the kind of debates about the relationship between law and politics, one of the defining conflicts, of course, of the 20th century, arguably, particularly in continental Europe, particularly in Germany, is in fact the conflict between Carl Schmitt and Hans Kelsen. And it's a funny story. I mean, on the one hand, to the extent that we are all committed to liberal democracy, you would want Hans Kelsen to be clearly the winner of that contest. And immediately after the Second World War, that seemed to be the case. There is a funny footnote somewhere in Kelsen where he just dismisses Carl Schmitt as you know, irrelevant, and that he had a fleeting fame there, you know, a Nazi jurist, etc. But when you look at the scholarly debates today, it's Carl Schmitt who is far more influential. And I also found his insights incredibly powerful. But so that creates a problem. So let me just state very clearly that I do not try to defend Schmitt. He's a horrible person and an atrocious thinker when it comes to his political judgment regarding Nazi Germany. He really openly supported Nazis and never disowned that misguided approach to German politics. But his insights about the weaknesses of liberalism and the problems that we still face today are absolutely compelling, I find. And so I'm not the first one to say that, but what I try to do is to think with Schmitt against Schmitt, as it were. I think that we are basically disempowering ourselves, not taking his criticism seriously. And this is exactly what we just discussed in relation to Russia, right? The post-political Europe is defenseless against Putin's Russia, right? So I found Schmitt perhaps the most interesting or influential of those that you mentioned. But then there are others you didn't mention that are important. Hannah Arendt, of course. And you see, so they are roughly the same generation, right? Max Weber, Carl Schmitt, Hannah Arendt. And they all share a common concern for what they called in German das Politische, the political, right? Which is a very peculiar kind of sphere of human activity. And they feared the process of depoliticization. They all wrote about it. And that is one of my concerns that I try to discuss in the book. Does the EU represent this kind of process of depoliticization? And that is corrosive of democracy. And what Schmitt says about Russia, actually, is just unbelievably interesting and continues its relevance. I mean, there is a quote, if I may.
Please do.
So, I cite it's a quote from the concluding section of the fifth chapter that deals with EU, Russia, and there it says Europe lives under the gaze of the more radical brother. The Russians are the new ascetics who are willing to forgo the comfort of the present for control of the future. They will dominate their own nature for the sake of dominating external nature in others. If European intellectuals continue to indulge they're passively aesthetic and rapture with the status quo, they abdicate their duty and privilege to lead, and they invite domination by their more radical brother. So the funny thing about this quote is that this is a summary of Schmitt's argument by McCormick, right? And so by Schmitt's argument during the Second World War, and so it's still relevant today, right? I think the misjudgment of the threat of this more revanchist, militaristic, revanchist Russia that is particularly common to this day amongst German intellectuals and, in fact, political elites, that misjudgment had profound and hugely damaging consequences to Europe. So, yes, I don't have the best framework, but I think there is a lot we can learn also from the enemies of liberalism, like Carl Schmitt, and that's what I try to do in the book.
Yeah, well, I mean, since we're quoting parts of the book, I'm going to quote parts of your book, which jumped out at me, related to the very point you were making there. The first is, Europe as a term performs the function of a religious incantation. Second is, not only is a united Europe not standing up against Russia, but individual member states that could and should have a stronger foreign policy are able to hide behind the EU's weakness and disunity. And the third is, Germany uses the EU's weakness to justify its own inaction. Anyone who's followed European affairs for a long time, even those who are sympathetic to the project, know that this is absolutely true. How aware do you think policymakers are and have been aware of this kind of thinking? Or is it naivety or is it cynicism, in your view?
Perhaps it's neither naivety nor cynicism. And all three quotes are particularly applicable to Germany. And you would have seen that I'm trying to cover way more than Germany. But of course, it's legitimate to spend a lot of one's book on Europe or this conversation on Germany, because it is, however reluctantly, the hegemonic power, right? I do write about France.
It's true, but
I... Eastern Europe. Go on.
But no, I would argue, I'm sure you would too, that yes, Germany hides behind this this incantation, but then other countries hide behind Germany, you know, Italy,
yes,
Spain,
of course,
yeah,
absolutely,
so,
particularly now, or Austria, right? Particularly now in the conflict with Ukraine. But so again, I mean, the current conflict, and mind you, all the three quotes perhaps are from the main part of the book that was written before the invasion, but. Particularly the current conflict illustrates that well, right, that Germany uses the EU's weakness to justify its own inaction. I mean, it's quite remarkable when you follow the current debates in Germany that Olaf Scholz and every member of his government stress time and again that, you know, this is not the time for German Alleingänge, that is, you know, a separate special path for Germany. We need to do everything in consensus with our allies, etc., while at the same time, in its reluctance to more strongly support Ukraine with, military equipment, with further sanctions. Germany is actually quite at odds with its allies. I mean, when you look at how much Americans have done for Ukraine, it dwarfs the efforts of Germany, that is the largest European economy, of course, and Europe's reluctant leader. So I do think that it is the case. But I wouldn't say it's cynicism or naivety. It's rather, I believe, it's the kind of misguided lessons that they have learned from history. And that is, again, something I do try to address in the book. I mean, the irony is that the Germans forgot their Carl Schmitt, right? And understandably so, because he was such a horrible person and he made such a horrible misjudgment in relation to the rise of Nazism. But Carl Schmitt is the one who understood that you cannot simply eradicate enmity from human affairs, and therefore you have to think about how to deal with the challenge that Putin's Russia, for example, represent. Again, there is a quote I could cite directly from Carl Schmitt, and it's 1928, right? So this is before the outbreak of the Second World War, before, you know, the Nazis take over, and before Carl Schmitt himself becomes a Nazi. He writes, "It would be a mistake to believe that a nation could eliminate the distinction of friend and enemy by declaring its friendship for the entire world or by voluntarily disarming itself. The world will not thereby become depoliticized and will not be transplanted into a condition of pure morality, pure justice, or pure economics. If a people is afraid of the trials and risks implied by existing in the sphere of politics, then another people will appear, which will assume these trials by protecting it against foreign enemies and thereby taking over political rule." I mean, this is incredibly timely now, right? So if Europeans are not willing to stand up for their values, then you have that threatening Russia to take over eventually, potentially large parts of Europe. And even if it's not an open military occupation of the rest of Europe, I mean, if Putin is allowed to get away with this, then really Western Europe too would be just living in the shadow of Russia. So that is about the importance of standing up for one's values, which is present in Schmitt's thinking about political community, that it has to have a shared purpose, right? And that takes me to that point you cited: Europe as a term performs the function of a religious incantation. I'm not convinced that Europe can provide all answers to problems that contemporary Europe, that Europeans face, right? So German politicians need to think about also what is in German national interest, what is in the interest of their voters, and that too even in relation to Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah. Well, you have a whole chapter where you talk about the original reason for this diplomatic approach, and you refer to how the Europeans have fallen back on this idea of the EU as an attraction, you know, the power of attraction, as opposed to exporting its values. Again, could you talk us through that idea?
Yes, so I draw on a short essay by David Martin Jones, who criticizes kind of Habermas's approach to international affairs, and again, it's so incredibly relevant. So David Martin Jones coined this term that I like so much: peace through conversation. You know, and Habermas interestingly just restated that position in relation to Russia today, which is, bizarre. A very sophisticated essay, but I think again, profoundly misguided. Ivan Krastev had a short commentary that also reflects on this predicament well. And that is that within Europe, within the EU as such, interdependence worked. And I acknowledge that. And I hope I give a fair representation of it in the book. But where Europeans, and again, particularly German politicians, but French too, made a mistake, they made themselves believe that same principle of interdependence can easily be applied to countries, powers outside of the EU. And so this is where the EU is now so incredibly vulnerable in relation to China, in relation to Russia, right? Because this interdependence didn't create a more peaceful, a more prosperous, a more stable world, right? When you pursue interdependence with a country like Putin's Russia, then you potentially make yourself more vulnerable rather than, somehow miraculously exporting your values, which is the whole ideal of soft power Europe. And it's the same, unfortunately, in relation to China. There are no signs of European way of thinking influencing Chinese politics, right? So again, in the German context, that is the misapprehension, I think, to some extent of their own history, this Wandel durch Handel, the idea that the end of the Cold War was somehow brought about by transformation caused through trade. Of course, the story is way more complicated, and what was important in that story, the demise of communism, was the preponderance of the U.S. kind of security umbrella that was erected over Europe, and in that competition between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, you know that it was quite clear that the Americans were serious in their determination to defend the Western world, etc. So it wasn't just soft power Europe that brought about the demise of communism.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this peace through conversation idea is, you discuss this in your chapter on Central European accession, where you seem to see the original sin in the Velvet Revolutions that allowed the communist elites to leverage their political dominance into economic power, which eventually undermined credibility of EU membership with the wider population. And you have this very nice quote where you say, the EU loves non-violent revolutions. It sees its own beauty reflected in them. Of course, this begs the question, and you originally come from Slovakia, on balance, would something bloodier, something more of a reckoning between the former communist elites and the rest of the population, would that have been a better outcome in the longer term?
Oh, no, something bloody, absolutely not. I mean, you don't want to present me as a bloodthirsty reactionary writer from Central Europe who dislikes the EU. I am a liberal.
Something more confrontational,
Confrontational. I think, I cite Martin Kroll, a brilliant Polish liberal, who wrote a book saying that we were all stupid. and I learned that actually from Timothy Garton Ash. He cites Martin Kroll in a different context. And what he wrote about was this misjudgment of the challenges that the collapse of communism brought about, right? That liberals perhaps were too quick to somehow accommodate the former elites. And then Avi Tucker, for example, wrote extensively about the problem that ensued, and that is that the former communist apparatchiks basically translated their political capital that they had, connections, networks, etc., into economic capital. So they became the new rich, right? And that obviously delegitimize the new order to some extent. And then when you see, for example, the Hungarian developments that are quite typical of this problem, everyone knows about Viktor Orban, and for a good reason, because he has damaged democratic governance in Hungary. But few people realize that what preceded Orban wasn't all that ideal either, and that was the country immediately before Orban's kind of takeover, like almost 20 years ago now. The country was ruled by a social democratic billionaire, Ferenc Gyurcsány, and his demise and the rise of Orban was triggered by Gyurcsány telling openly his party comrades that they've been lying to their people, that it's all corrupt, right? And they've been lying morning and evening and whatnot. And the same Gyurcsány was loved in Brussels because he was very pro-European, right? But the country was not an ideal kind of rule of law democracy, right? So there was this problem that the nominally left-wing political parties calling themselves social democrats were often just fairly corrupt kind of tools for politicians to enrich themselves. I mean, Slovakia, actually my homeland, presents another example of that trend, where Robert Fico, who was recently charged actually, and he was lucky not to get his parliamentary immunity removed, he also was the leader of what he called the Social Democratic Party, and he was loved in Brussels because he was playing the game most of the time as a pro-EU politician, right? So there were significant challenges there, and I think partly caused by perhaps that revolution being too velvet. But I am not saying that it should have been more violent. The challenge of that transition was underestimated. Understandingly so, of course. I don't know how it could have been done better, but I think many of those legacies are not fully understood by a number of fellow scholars who look at the process of democratic backsliding. I have a problem with that very term because it somehow assumes that there was some kind of marvelous democracy in any of those countries in 1990s. Then there wasn't, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, a constant theme and related to this, and a major contrast you draw in the book is between the seriousness with which the EU, and particularly Germany, managed the sovereign debt crisis, and contrasting that with the light touch approach or lightish touch approach to dealing with illiberalism and dealing with Ukraine. And I thought about this hard, and I'm not sure it's so different, because even when it came to economic crisis, the EU never acts in advance. It always waits until it can see a crisis right before it does anything meaningful. You saw this throughout the sovereign debt crisis. So isn't that the issue, that Crimea, you know, the takeover of Crimea was something that was not big enough a crisis to react in a crisis manner, the same with dealing with Viktor Orban. How would you respond to that argument?
I might just shift the emphasis of your question, if you allow, because I just realized that there is a term that we haven't discussed much, if at all, and it's in the subheading of my book. And that is sovereignty, right? And it's a funny one. And I use the term by saying that Europeans delude themselves thinking about a post-sovereign Europe, etc. But you know, like you look at any textbook about the European Union, and you will learn that the EU proves that category is obsolete, right? Isn't that funny that the debt crisis you just described is called sovereign debt crisis, right? And isn't that funny that is one bit of sovereignty that was not supranationalized, right, easily? So the Greek sovereign debt remains Greek, right? And there are ways in which Greece was assisted in making it more European, but I don't think that you would be able to convince many Greek voters that the way in which it was done was to the benefit of Greece. And so sovereignty to me is a very useful category. And then again, Schmitt's definition of sovereignty, particularly in times of crisis, sovereignty who decides on the exception, right? So what happened during the sovereign debt crisis? I don't know whether I would say that Europeans were more serious or Germans were more serious when dealing with sovereign debt crisis than with other challenges. But what happened with the sovereign debt crisis, when the entire edifice started to collapse, right? And the EU is a strange polity that doesn't have a ruler, it doesn't have a sovereign. Then who decided on the exception? Mario Draghi, not the Italian prime minister, but the then president of the European Central Bank. So to me, the story is instructive in the way in which that crisis massively eroded democracy in Europe. Whoever the Greek voters chose as their leader, the country for a decade was led de facto by this troika, right? The European Central Bank, Brussels, and the International Monetary Fund. And of course, for many people, Angela Merkel, ultimately, right? And I don't even have firm views about the particular set of policies that were adopted. Many of those reforms may well have been necessary, but it is for the Greek electorate to adopt a strategy, right? Not for Mario Draghi and the ECB, a non-majoritarian technocratic institution, to de facto rule a country like Greece, right? So to me, this is clearly a story that illustrates that the idea that sovereignty somehow no longer matters is misguided, right? And the very concept of sovereign debt actually is an illustration that even as a legal term, sovereignty remains absolutely necessary, right? So who is responsible for national debt, right? It's not individual voters. It's not the government of the day. It's the sovereign nation, actually, that's ultimately responsible for it.
Yes. Well, it's funny you say, I would probably argue that Mario Draghi was the effective only sovereign because of a decision made by Angela Merkel not to take action. She played chicken with the ECB and she won.
The European political elites abdicated the responsibility, and so there was no other actor left but the ECB to do something. Absolutely. But to me, it's a marvelous illustration of the dysfunction of EU governance, right? And it is one of those things that is kind of, I mean, I got frustrated with a lot of sophisticated EU literature where you have a sense that colleagues smarter than me delight in the complexity of EU governing structures, right? And then, you know, develop these elaborate terminologies and scholarly apparatus to describe what's going on. But then you look at what happens in the times of emergency, in the times of crisis, and it's just not very democratic, right? And as I said from the outset, my primary commitment is towards democracy. I don't believe that more Europe is always a better Europe. In the case of Greece, I think it would have been better for Greece and everyone else if Greece was allowed to extricate itself from the euro. In fact, it should have been bribed into exiting the euro than having like a lost decade. The youth unemployment is probably still incredibly high, and there are years after the low point of the whole story. So, yes, that's...
Well, except there, you make a point about Hungary, for example, and you're critical of arguments that Hungary should be either forced to leave or there should be some kind of exit mechanism for Hungary, and your argument is that would punish the Hungarians who want to stay in the EU. And that was the case in Greece too, right? That a lot of Greeks, in fact, the majority of Greeks, they didn't like the policies that were imposed on them, but at the same time, they wanted to keep the euro. So isn't that the same democratic problem?
Maybe, but mind you, I would differentiate between exiting the euro, the single European currency, and exiting the European Union. But you are right. I mean, there was a strong public support, and probably still is for the euro. But to the extent that the single European currency basically is incompatible with maintaining genuine control over fiscal policies. I mean, monetary policies, of course, you gave away to European Central Bank, but even fiscal policies cannot be independently pursued. I think it massively damaged democracy in Europe. And I don't know, there is no easy way out of this, but I want at least to be able to diagnose it. Fritz Schaap, a distinguished German economist, is an oddball who suggested a few years ago that the euro should be dismantled in an orderly fashion, which is probably easier said than done. But I think at least that kind of conversation is needed, right? But the continuing consensus, particularly among EU scholars, is that the euro has been somehow successful. And I really don't see how that can be maintained, because when you look at the political aims of the single European currency, and remember that all these economic projects ultimately had political aims. Well, the key political aim was to unite Europe even more strongly, right? And at least to some extent, to you know, equalize economic conditions across Europe. And neither of those two aims have been achieved, right? Like, there is probably still today more hostility towards Germany, not just in Greece, but in Italy, in Spain, Portugal, than was, say, 50 years ago, right? So that's not a success story in my view. And when it comes to discrepancies, economic discrepancies, well, Italy has stagnated basically since the introduction of the euro, and that's a large economy, right? That matters a great deal. In fact, so we don't talk about the Eurozone crisis for obvious reasons because we are preoccupied with Russia, but I think that it isn't gone, and if anything, now the economic challenges that the war in Ukraine has created is likely to bring that crisis back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the other crisis we haven't mentioned was the refugee crisis, but we've touched on it, and it seemed to me you made an unusual argument for books in EU studies when it came to management of the refugee crisis and migration generally. You say big developed welfare states rely on a shared sense of solidarity, and, quote, as the boundaries became more porous or non-existent, the sense of shared responsibility for common good dissipates. And you also stress the importance of effective security. As I say, this isn't a fashionable argument in academia. Have you met resistance to these ideas that were standard, for example, on the center left across Europe until quite recently?
I mean, whenever I present anything at conferences, I meet resistance. But what people will make of the book, we are yet to see. It only came out last week. But mind you, the particular point that you just made is not that controversial. I think I'm just not sure whether people are all that keen to acknowledge it. But I cite two prominent scholars, and both would be seen and see themselves as being on the left side of politics. So it's David Miller, of course, who is at Nuffield College, Oxford, and he has consistently argued that when you think of effective welfare state, you need the national community to sustain it, right? Because only then people are willing to accept redistributive taxation policies, etc., and that you need a contained policy to make it affordable and manageable. And there is a very prominent and certainly very left-wing intellectual and sociologist scholar, Klaus Offe, in Germany, who made an argument like 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, talking about Entgrenzung als Selbstentpflichtung. That's the beauty of German language, actually, that you can combine these different terms in two words. And that is, he talked about deterioralization leading to desolidarization, Selbstentpflichtung, right? And I mean, that is not new. I mean, that has been well understood by political thinkers in the past. That you know, if you just feel attachment to humanity, then your obligations become unmanageable, and you end up not doing all that much. While if your political community is fairly clearly defined, then these redistributive projects like welfare state are more likely to be maintained. So I don't think that is that controversial. Perhaps what is controversial is to question the wisdom of Merkel's policies in 2015. And I'm afraid that the more I read about Merkel, the more I learned to accept that the image that she had, particularly outside of Germany, was quite disproportionately positive or at odds with what she really was. There is a brilliant book by Robin Alexander, a journalist working for Die Welt, newspaper in Germany, that is called Die Getriebenen, and that focuses actually on migration crisis, but identifies a pattern in Merkel's approach to politics. She was not a leader. She was just driven. That is the meaning of the Getriebene. She was driven by ever-changing public mood. And so she made arguments against migration, and then the public mood in Germany turned in favor of migration, and then she suddenly, without consulting even her coalition partners, let alone European partners, she suddenly changed the EU policy, the Dublin Agreement. She opened the borders, and the situation just became very chaotic, unmanageable, and the support for migration then in Germany and in Europe dissipated very quickly. So you need to think about the consequences of your policies, which Merkel, she was not strategic. I mean, it's the same story. Regrettably, it's even more important now, the move away from nuclear power, right? That was a kind of knee-jerk reaction to the disaster in Japan. Then people in Germany started to get worried, and overnight she changed the entire direction of Germany's energy policy. And we see the consequences, right, of it today, where she just made the country even more reliable on Russia, a catastrophic strategic choice, right? So she was not really a leader. And yet, at the same time, she was celebrated in major Western American media as the leader of the Western world, etc. I mean, she is very impressive. I always found when watching her presenting, etc., that she seemed incredibly competent and a very effective communicator, without charisma, but very effective, right? It worked for Germans. But her major choices were catastrophic, and they were not made in a kind of strategic manner that the leader of Germany, let alone the leader of the Western world, should have done.
Yeah. Well, you end the book by saying, quote, "Europe's political elites will need to stop chasing Arcadia, the promised land of the post-national or supranational democracy, if they wish to regain popular support." And I'd certainly agree with that. But apart from what they should stop doing, what do you think they should start doing?
Well, that's very well observed, because it is true that what I do mostly is to criticize what went wrong, and I don't give prescriptions. Prescriptions are always harder than critical analysis. Mind you, the lack of prescriptions is kind of consistent with my approach and the overall argument of the book. I do not believe in great revolutionary projects, right? That is my problem with the Maastricht Treaty Europe, that there was a kind of leap into a post-political, post-national, quasi-federation. I do not think it is wise or helpful to imagine this kind of bold projects, the end of nation states, etc. But yet I would have prescriptions, and the basic prescription is, you know, promise less and do more modesty, less hubris, you know. More Europe is not always the best answer, I believe. It would be useful and desirable to see how democracy can be revitalized at national level. National politicians can start by simply taking more responsibility for their actions. So when you think of Germany, then Germany should stop hiding behind Europe. When you think of Poland, right, we didn't talk about that much, but of course the challenges both in Poland and Hungary in terms of erosion of judicial independence and the freedom of the media, and all these challenges are very serious. But there I would say to my liberal Polish friends, you know, try to do what you can within the Polish national community rather than seeking some kind of salvation from Europe. So democracy is an open-ended project, an imperfect project. There are no technocratic solutions to all its many problems. And I think perhaps it requires courage now to think about a Europe that promises less and could deliver more. I mean, I find it quite revealing and interesting that Macron now gave this major speech in response to the challenge of Russia, yeah, where he is saying to Ukrainians that, ooh, we'll find a new way of accommodating you outside of the EU. I think it would be wiser and more responsible to think of how to reimagine the EU as a whole in a way that would allow the EU also to bring in Ukraine much earlier, much faster than is conceivable in the current kind of with the current governing structure. So an EU that would be less supranational, less ambitious in its never-ending march towards a quasi-federation, would also be better equipped to deal with the legitimate desire of Ukrainians to be brought in very quickly, right, and informally. So a less technocratic Europe is something I would wish, and a Europe that is more controlled by its member states in its nation states.
Okay. Well, as a final question, and it's my usual one since this is a podcast about books, I have asked Stefan to recommend two books to listeners, one from his field and one personal choice. So what have you chosen?
Well, from my own field, I love all books by Ivan Krastev. I don't always agree with everything he argues, but particularly After Europe, which is one of the recent ones, I would recommend anything by Ivan Krastev. And the more general choice, the beautiful kind of combined biography of four remarkable Europeans, Wittgenstein, Benjamin, Cassirer, and Heidegger, and that is Time of the Magicians by Wolfram Allenberger. I read the book a couple of years ago in German, but it also came out in an English translation. I strongly, strongly recommend it. Beautifully written, compelling stories of extraordinary lives and an extraordinary moment in European history that kind of redefined the story of philosophy for generations to come. So Time of the Magicians by Wolfram Allenberger.
Great. Okay. Well, that's a new one. So thank you for that. Today, I've been talking to Stefan Auer about his European Disunion, published by Hearst in May in the UK and coming out through OUP in the US during the summer. Stefan, thanks very much for coming on.
Thank you so much for your kind invitation. It was a pleasure.